Matt Jelly held his first ever bylaw crawl Saturday, February the 6th. It was bloody cold out there, I've got to tell you. We were freezing.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
Matt's a great guy. He organizes a lot of things. He pays attention. He has heart. He cares about what's going on in this city. He organizes bylaw crawl, and what he wants to do is have some more eyes on the street. Because one of the problems that he's found when he's gone to City Hall is that there just simply is not enough people out there from city staff to look around and to see what's going on with buildings, to see if they're falling apart. Personal story. I called in two times to City Hall when I could see a roof that was wide open and water was pouring right into it every time it rained. It went on for years. Little drops of the asphalt roof falling onto my balcony. For 4 years, it went on like this, four summers. So I called the city bylaw office, and it didn't come right away, but a bylaw officer did come. But he didn't seem to think that there was any problem. He didn't think there was anything seriously wrong. When you're looking at a gaping hole that keeps peeling back with the wind, that is about, I would say a good 6 to 8 inches in circumference, something's wrong. I called because I wanted the owner of the building to know what was happening to his building. He had just put a new roof on, so whoever did the work was causing a lot of damage by not doing a good job. If you pay for somebody to do your roof, you assume that the job is good. But let's get back to the bylaw crawl. What is a bylaw crawl? Well, of course, it is an event designed to locate, identify, and report properties which are in violation of the City of Hamilton's property standards bylaw in hopes of proactively preventing further decay and demolition of Hamilton's building stock and ensuring that buildings do not pose a danger to the public. And if anybody remembers King William Street and saw that video on YouTube, it was pretty frightening to see that entire old building right beside the Lister block just suddenly fold up like an accordion. We were so lucky that an independent citizen captured it on his video phone, literally, and posted it on YouTube. So what does Matt hope to accomplish by this? Well, the effective bylaw enforcement is the only tool that citizens have to ensure properties don't fall into disrepair and require demolition. And if you lived in this city for any length of time, you know that there's a lot of demolition by default. Property owners just let the building sit there empty for decades until they rot and fall apart right out from under people. It's just, I don't understand it. Matt says what we're looking for, and you can do this too if you've got a camera and you can fill out the form. What to look for is broken windows, unsecured entrances. Matt found a door that was wide open in a back alley. Anybody could go into that building. Missing rooftops, damaged rooftops, uncleared snow after 24 hours. Good luck with that one. I've been fighting City Hall for years to get two blocks cleared of snow so that I can get my wheelchair to the grocery store. That's pretty serious stuff. Rubble and debris. Well, I've got one of those guys in my neighborhood, too. He likes to hoard and gather basically garbage. I don't know what he's doing with it, but it's just garbage. Look for significant cracks in foundation walls, rubble foundations with gaping holes, significant cracks in the above-grade brick walls. I have that in my building. Mortar joints opening up, creating large gaps between the mortar and unit masonry and bricks. Door and window frames dramatically out of square. Doors and window lintels, that's the supports above the opening, severely sagging or deflecting. Falling bricks. Fallen bricks, brick spalling. Spalling, that means the face of the brick is open and chipping away little bit by little bit, year after year. Bulging walls, bowing walls, tilted or leaning chimneys, parapet and overhanging leanings that are about to pull away from the building. Now, you probably want to know, okay, so I see this building or this piece of property and I've taken a photograph of it. What do I do next? Well, you can send it to the bylaw office at City Hall and you can find them on the web. Or you can go to www.bylawcrawl.ca. That's all one word, bylawcrawl. That's Matt Jelly's webpage. It will give you the list of what I'm holding here in my hand. It's a multi-page document that explains and describes everything that you need to look for. Do it block by block. See if you can get a couple of friends. Do it block by block and take a camera with you every time you go out. and just record what you see. I think we're all going to be very, very amazed at just how much property damage is out there already and how much more we have to look for. Now, what I want to play right now, just to give us a reminder of what happened to City Hall the last time they didn't pay any attention to the citizens over the Red Hill Valley fight. Pretty amazing. I don't think I've ever seen anybody take over City Hall before, but that night, I happened to be there.
Right now, about 150 people are marching right into City Hall after that ceremony outside. All the lights are up, the counselors are at the tables.
Situation where we have to vote against it now, but we've never voted for it in the past. And through you to staff, how did we come to this point where we've written off that segment of the loan with the Ticats that was outstanding with the Ticats without it ever having come to us before? Through you to the staff.
Through you, Mr. Mayor, last summer or last fall, the verbal report was provided to council highlighting the changes in the that in fact the company, the legal company that we that owed us the money, had gone bankrupt. We had no legal recourse to recover those cars, and so therefore that's why it's been recommended to be written out.
At that time, Mr. Mayor, should we not have had a process in place where we as a council could have debated the issue and determined whether or not we wanted to write off that $500,000 or $700,000? Or is this perfectly acceptable practice? I'm just trying to get a clarification.
The fact of the matter is that we have the facts as they present themselves right now. What might have happened back in November, October, or whenever that first came up, we can't undo, but let's learn from it. Well, let's hope it doesn't happen again. Let's learn from it.
Okay.
My suggestion.
So I guess that begs the question, though, are there any other write-offs that are being pursued without council direction?
Well, that's good. So, again, with number six. Number six, all in favor, let's take the vote again. All in favor? Opposed? With the exception of the individuals who want to be recorded as opposed. Number seven. Number eight. Number nine. Number 10. Number 11. Number 12. Number 12. Number 13. I'm afraid it's going to be very difficult to conduct the business of council, and this is a public hall. We want people to be in here, but they need to be respectful of the protocol to allow council to do its work. Okay, all right, ladies and gentlemen, I'm just going to ask you to maintain some decorum in the council chamber. And just allow council to do its business, and please refrain from expressing any of your sentiments in a vocal way. Thank you.
What happens is, some land developer who happens to be a friend or a relative of the mayor, just happens to be, decides they want to develop a subdivision out on beautiful farmland, some of the best in the world. And what they do is they get the city has a plan called Vision 2020, and they're supposed to be thinking about the future and the environment. They're not supposed to expand the city boundaries. They're supposed to keep it in. But every time a friend of the mayor comes, a land developer, the people who pay for the mayor's $330,000 election campaign, they come up and knock on Larry's door and say, Larry, remember who's paying your election campaign expenses? We are. We have a development. We want you to extend the city boundary. And Larry says, okay, tell me how. And what they do is they buy 500 acres. And the environmentalist came and said, no, you can't expand the boundary.
It's still Indian land.
But they got the OMB to do that. They are building a road. The Red Hill Expressway is a road to open up development for these land developers. How does that have to do with the budget? The budget, there's only a limited amount of dollars they can squeeze out of the taxpayer. And so, instead of taking that money and spending it on affordable housing, on library hours, opening up the recreation centers they've closed on the weekend, instead of revitalizing the core, instead of fixing the streets that are falling apart, where do they put the money? They put it into the expressway. They put it in their expressway, and everything else in the city suffers. We are heading towards a bankruptcy situation, and all of this is done for the mantra of economic development. There's only one group's economic development that's going to develop out of this budget, and that's Larry Deani and some of these aldermen's land developer and speculator friends. And I say, that's not right. That money should go to mass transit. Is that right?
Yes.
Should that money be allocated to keeping city workers on the job and expanding services? Should that money be put into mass transit instead of an expressway? Should that money go to alternate means of transportation like bike lanes? Should that money go to tree planting programs instead of those $250,000 homes they're going to build on that farmland I was telling you about? Should it go to affordable housing for people who are living on that? Brothers and sisters, these people here are living in a dream world. And it's only when real people come here and tell them how they should be acting that they start to wake up. So I hope that from now on, you people will make sure that you stay apprised of the situation that's going on and that you work in order to get rid of the people here. Oh, I would say there's a dozen of them who are here because the land developers pay their election expenses every time. Not cheap election expenses. It's $25,000, $30,000 that we know about. And in Larry Deani's case, $330,000. That's a lot of money. So, my point, ladies and gentlemen, is from now on, don't let them live here in this dream world thinking that they can run things without any flack and our money.
This city has no right to privatize our water. It's going to an American water company. We have a right to have access to affordable water, public service, not where we're paying and paying and paying. And where is this money? Where is it going? And then we're going to be accountable about the contract, what's happening. There's no accountability.
Aubrey's going to say something here in a minute, but I got one suggestion we can do. Let's send our tax money to Arnie General. He'll probably do a better job of looking after this city than they do. Ignatius, put in a Shawnee.
Go, Jim. Okay, I've never done anything like this before. So when I came and sat on the...
Aubrey!
So when I... But I think it got to the point where I realized, you know what? This is my city hall.
That's right.
These are the people that I hire. So you know what? This is ours. And I'm glad you guys all came down with me. And I think it's bloody time we take this city back.
Let me just have your attention just for a second, folks, okay?
Let them speak.
All right, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, you've now made your point, I think. You have come to council, and you have stated your opinions. You've been on television. You've had your say, and just listen to me. Just listen to me for a second. Thank you. I'm trying to be respectful of you, and please be respectful of us as well. You've had your say. There's obviously, this is obviously an issue that is going to be hotly debated and hotly contested for a long, long time, and we need to listen to all sides in a respectful way. You have stated your point of view. You've had your say for a fair amount of time now. I'm going to ask you on behalf of the democracy that you are saying you want to uphold, I'm going to ask you to please leave, take your seats in a quiet way, and will just allow us to carry on with the meeting. We're almost done with the meeting. I'm asking you to do that, please. And if you don't do that, then I'm going to ask the police to help out. Okay? So please.
Why is it that City Hall citizens can't see what happens to our budget? And what is being spent? What is being cut? Okay. Why is this not happening? Why don't you do this and present this? Why is it always tabled and it's not presented to the public? We want to know why. You do not want to be fair and upfront with the people. So please present the budget to the people so it's an open process.
I think, if I can just interject here, I think that you guys know that I'm with you on most of these issues, as is Councillor Horvath and some other councillors as well, Councillor Perola. However, there's a situation here that may lead to the police coming in and moving people out. Do we want to do that? I also want to mention, just in case you're wondering, there's a session where we're closing the meeting with tonight, we're supposed to close the meeting with tonight, which deals with, and it was an in-camera session. It means that everybody has to leave because it was a legal issue, but what it was the 1701 treaty, which applies to Red Hill Valley. We wanted to deal with that tonight because I've got a lot of questions to ask about that. But it's supposed to be in camera because it's a legal issue, and the city's in going to be in courts. So we're going to try and deal with that tonight. So that would be a positive thing from the perspective of dealing with the expressway issue. So I just throw that out. If you guys don't want to do that, that's fine. But that's something that would help us as a city, I think, to deal with the expressway issue. But
who's here to speak for the Six Nations on the NFAN treaty?
Yeah. Heard Councillor McCaddy as well, and I'm going to ask people to leave now. And I'm going to ask the police in a nice way to ask people to leave right now, please. Thank you, officers.
Ladies and gentlemen, okay, you are now trespassing under the Trespass to Property Act. Everybody is asked to leave the building. Okay. Okay. And I too pay taxes, sir. But you have to leave the building now.
Okay.
I'm going to have to leave the council chambers. I'm afraid that the safety of the people in this chamber is under risk, and I'm sorry. I was democratically elected to represent my ward. I democratically bring to this council debate every chance I get the issues that we all talked about all night tonight. And I don't mean we in terms of the city council. I mean we in terms of outside in the forecourt. But I gotta tell you, if you're gonna get progressives elected, and then the forces of darkness that you are all against are gonna do the exact same thing that you're doing here, and I can't support that. So I'm glad you all came out tonight, and I hope everybody stays safe.
There's been some slanted news reports in our local media lately concerning the Douglas Estates dispute, the Six Nations. It's been 4 years almost since the Six Nations took possession of their land, and it has always been their land. But what we're talking about lately is some fella who thinks he has a right to call the OPP and take them to court because they didn't protect the white people living there. It's all very bigoted and biased and very uninformed and actually crude and ignorant. Gary McHale has no business being involved with this topic. He used to live in Richmond Hill. He decided to get himself involved in somebody else's dispute, I think just because he wants attention. So he moved to Caledonia. But guys like him, they don't solve anything. They just keep the fight going. They keep ignorance going. They don't inform themselves. They don't get the education they need before they can stand up and speak and represent other people. And I really seriously question one particular reporter's biased reports. They are so slanted, so one-sided. It's disgusting. I have a feeling that this summer some of the disputes will start up again. And what I saw and what I've always seen is when the fights start and when the hurling of insults start, it's always white men, young white men, standing in front of the Six Nation people being ignorant and as rude as any human being can be. They're not doing anything that they should personally be proud of. I have this recording. It's not the greatest audio, but it's a recording from the Six Nations Confederacy as they discuss among themselves their history and what's really happening on that land and the truth about government and why it's taking so long to solve that land dispute. It has always taken a long time to solve a land dispute. And the reason is money and possession of the land and being able to take and confiscate land for the resources on it, to build more suburbs on it. The only thing standing between wall-to-wall sprawl and more farmland, if we have any left, is First Nations and their right to have their property and their land, which they were promised. It was an agreement for their treaty rights to take control of their land, not to allow suburban sprawl everywhere. What the white man is not understanding here is if you keep plopping houses down on every square inch of property you can get your hands on, you won't have any land left to grow food. It doesn't occur to them because they go to a grocery store and they buy their food from who knows where. They don't care. They didn't get involved with the growing process. They have no idea where it comes from. We're heading for big trouble. We have too many people. Our population is growing, but the people that seem to advise government officials, the guys that seem to think that they speak for everybody, they think they have the right to spread their ignorance, change the bylaws, push with lawyers, shove ahead really fast so that if they can get at least 60% of whatever their agenda is done by the time situations get into court, well, then the judge can say to them, well, you've put so much money into it, you've already moved your project along this far, I don't think that we can stop it at this point. That is the plan that I've always seen planners and city hall lawyers do. I gotta say, I'm always disgusted by watching it. When you're young, you're in your 20s and 30s, you're seeing stuff for the first time, and it doesn't really impact you that much. But when you get a little long in the tooth, you're seeing the same situation being repeated decade after decade after decade, and it's being done in exactly the same way that it was done 25 years ago, and 35 years ago, and 50 years ago. And the way that we have planned our society hasn't worked. It doesn't work. We shove people into cars, force them to live in a society that if you don't have a car, then you're isolated from friends and food and society. But the problem is you're isolated anyway. You're sitting in a square box of metal. Once you get your hands on that steering wheel, you seem to think that nothing can touch you. What people need to do, everybody that drives out there all the time, you don't have any idea what it's like to walk around downtown. Just try it once. Just park your car, get out downtown, and walk at least two blocks on King Street or Main Street, and do it on a weekday just for the excitement of the transport trucks whizzing by you within 3 feet or less of where you stand to wait to cross the road.
You are listening to The Other Side of the News on 93.3 CFMU FM.
And now the Confederacy explains once again, and I hope you guys can hear this audio, what's going on with the government and what's really happening up there at Six Nations.
Taking of land, taking of resources, unfettered exploitation of natural resources worth trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars. What do you think stands in the way of the last great barrier to the crown as an institution or the governments or us getting unfettered access to exploitation of trillions and trillions of dollars worth of natural resources? What is the barrier that stands in the way? Indigenous peoples who hold the rights to and in respect of the lands. Do you remove that barrier by various methodologies of sometimes even warfare and oppression? And you get that unfettered access. It's about power and it's about money at the end of the day. It's also about lack of political will. Information is power. If Indigenous people's voices were heard and supported through school systems, from when kids are reading things, all the way up through the school systems, through the media, through government publications or what have you, if voices were heard, then the power to Indigenous people's positions and rights would start to be better restored, which means that barrier to unfettered access to those trillions of dollars would stand strongly and firmly, and the institutional framework of the Crown and industry in Canada does not want that to happen. I'm not talking about individuals here, I'm not saying the Prime Minister or individuals, but the institution as the Crown and institutions of industry do not want that barrier to stand strong and firm. They do not want power restored to Indigenous peoples who have full rights to it. That's why this is taking so long. It's also why land claims take so long to get settled, because of gross lack of political will. This entrenched adversarial attitude on behalf of provincial and federal crowns that they must fight these things. Why? On what legal footing? There isn't any. You know, you've heard this figure thrown out there. I'll give this one example and then I'll stop. That Indians in Canada get $9 billion a year from the federal government. Oh my God, where is all that coming from? Us taxpayers. How come they get so much? Do you know that a significant portion of that, perhaps two-thirds, is actually spent on the federal government administration of Indian affairs? There are gigantic bureaucracies out there that feed themselves, creating make-work projects, taking 10 steps to do what a child would take one. This process, land claims get stalled and mired because of lack of political will, because funds are channeled into massive bureaucracies that are designed to stall processes, very much like the residential schools adjudication process that was established. I don't have the exact figures, but something like 75% of funding for that process did not go to the victims or survivors of residential school abuse, but went to the bureaucracy. This has been widely covered a while ago in the media. So, lack of political will and systems and bureaucracies designed to stall and perpetuate abuse. As is a power, raw power, as is itself. International law is predominantly made by imperialist powers because they have the power in the UN and in other organizations. So, imperial / colonial powers. And European states, Russia, Japan, China, United States, basically make international law. Others participate, but they don't have the power to sway. So that's Indigenous peoples who do not participate directly in the process of making and enforcing international law, because the situation in Canada is prevalent around the world. Indigenous peoples' rights have been disrespected and abused for much the same reasons around the world, and are often, it's not the Indigenous population that is the governing authority in the country, in the nation state. And their own governing authority is not recognized by the nation state, so they don't participate directly in this process. Nonetheless, the reason I raised international law is because without even having to go to indigenous law, indigenous people's own laws, you can look directly at our laws of non-Aboriginal peoples from way back when to today and say those laws themselves, the laws that the British Crown and today the Canadian Crown say they're governed by, are laws that told them they couldn't do what they purported to do, which makes it, they're bound by their own laws and yet they ignored those, their own laws when it was convenient to do so. And that's the reason I raised that point. The UN, the system at the UN is you have to seek a redress domestically through all domestic adjudicative processes that you can access before you can go to the UN for redress. And so it's set up to force you to exhaust all local remedies first before you can go there. And so it forces Indigenous peoples here to turn to the Canadian court system, which is getting better, but still not really addressing the nature of their rights and the abuses to those rights.
There were people down for being on welfare. We're not on welfare. The people don't understand the money that if people were on welfare, that is the money that they hold in trust. That's not welfare. That's just giving back a little piece of what they owe us. And Canada would be bankrupt if they paid back what was in the trustee and they gave it to all the wrong people. When they made my mom ashamed of who she was, that was passed down to me to be ashamed of who I was, which took my dignity away. It took everything from me, for me and my brothers and my sisters. We were ashamed to go in the home because we were dirty, because they gave us the land. The ground gave us was full of clay. Can't support yourself, can't grow a lot of vegetables. There's nothing over there. But I'd like to thank the panel now. I'd like to thank you for helping us, for speaking out on our behalf. And I'm sorry we haven't come with you both.
Thank you so much for sharing. I heard you deeply affected me, and thank you for bringing it. International law is not above domestic law, because international law is a system by which it is, I'm talking about Western international law, by which it's understood, developed, and enforced. It's developed and enforced by nations. And those nations say, we come first. In other words, our laws, our domestic laws, govern us here first. Although Canada says we abide by treaties and conventions and other things of international law, if there's any conflict between domestic and international, domestic governs to international human rights law in particular. But see what's happening here in this country. We know very often it's lip service and not much else. In fact, Canada is one of a collectivity of four nations that are fighting to weaken, water down, and discredit the draft declaration on the rights of Indigenous peoples, a treaty yet to be decided upon. Canada and some other countries are at the vanguard of fighting this, so think about that. Because domestic law, Canada says it trumps, Canada applies its own domestic legal process to the land claims. Canada says international law doesn't apply. Many Indigenous people say, Canada, you're wrong. Only nations can enter into treaties. Britain entered into a treaty with we as the nation, being Haudenosaunee Nation or Cree Nation or entities thereof or what have you. Assiniboine Nation, Ojibwe or Anishinaabe Nation. Only nation to nation, internationally governed, internationally legally governed, can treaties be understood. It's somehow, and of course the Royal Proclamation says the same thing. Britain itself, years ago, said the same thing. treaties or nation-to-nation treaties. It's the only way that they could be understood in Canada. Somehow, mysteriously, that changed from domestic, from international government treaties between nations to domesticated treaties that are now governed solely by the law of Canada. Now, tell me how that could possibly come to be. It can't, legally. It's another abusive fact that has been somehow morphed into law without any justification for doing so. So Canada says only domestic law applies because everything's now domesticated and Canada's laws are imposed on Indigenous peoples here. But it's often what Indigenous peoples here must live with.
Can we have the next question, please? And one article or item of international law that will be of particular interest would be the International Convention on the Prevention and the Punishment of Crime and Genocide. And speaking to what you're talking about, this morphing of how it is that, actually, let's go back for a second, talk about how Canada was instrumental in watering down the current creation of the Indigenous Convention that you're speaking about. Canada was also very instrumental in watering down the International Convention on the Crime of Genocide, along with a number of other colonizing nations at the time in 48. And then when Canada implemented that convention into their own laws, the Genocide Convention has five articles. I won't list them all, but one of which is taking children from one group of taking children from their own group of people and putting them into another. And when Canada put that convention into practice in their own laws, they took out immediately just that article along with a couple of other ones. And then following that, getting back to this point of how it is that they said that domestic law supersedes international law, Canada unilaterally declared Native people citizens of Canada. But if you're talking about nation to nation, then this really should be issues that are addressed in an international court. And so Canada was very forward-thinking in the sense of putting into place provisions that prevent Indigenous people from taking their particular claims to international forays. I just wanted to add that.
Worked for a while around this issue. And I guess I wanted to maybe say a few things. One thing that I think is really important in terms of how this issue gets framed or how this issue is talked about is that basically a lot of what we hear in the media and a lot of what is sort of being portrayed is a very specific conflict between Native people and non-Native people. And it's sort of buried into this little minutia of people complaining about specific problems that occurred, or noise, or weeds on the site, or all sorts of things like this, and we lose track of the fact that what is happening at in regards to the Douglas Creek Estates is about much more than relationships just between people of Six Nations and people of California. That it is something that affects all of the Baldwin Tract. That it is an issue of basic justice and human rights, but that it needs to be dealt with over this huge landmass of the Baldwin Tract, with millions of non-Native people living in Kitchener, Waterloo, in a whole series of towns along the Grand River. And then if we look at what is likely to happen in the coming years, and if we look at other land claims that are taking place, there's land claims over parts of downtown Hamilton, there's land claims over the Toronto Islands, which were never ceded, in parts of downtown Toronto. You have all of British Columbia, which is unceded territory, in which there are literally hundreds of land claims happening. There are hundreds of land claims in Ontario. And you have a kind of new phase of Canadian extensionism into the far north, where Aboriginal people still make up a large majority of that population, and a whole number of issues with the pipeline that's supposed to bring natural gas to the tar sands. And so this is for us, and for everybody in Canada, for non-Native and Natives, this is what's happening in Caledonia. This is a microcosm of what's going to be happening elsewhere, what has happened elsewhere, but what I think the point is to continue to intensify. And so in response to that, I think we have to be, one of the main reasons as to why Community Friends was founded and was organized, and the thing that's been guiding our work, is not to allow this whole debate to be polarized into a Native versus non-Native issue, but to be clear that there are groups within, there's many differentiated the, these protests against Six Nations and this kind of stuff. We also see, and we also have to look at who can be potentially allies to Six Nations within non-Native communities. And that's where I think the role of the union movement plays a massive role. And it's very important. The Canadian Labour Congress came out and supported Six Nations, and that's hundreds of thousands or half a million or a million members. The CAW did, QB did, OXU did, and our group is made up of over a dozen different people from unions that are working to do that. We also need to look at building alliances with environmentalists and human rights activists from a variety of different struggles that are all tied in together. And I think that's really what we have to leave this meeting thinking about, is how to make sure that there's other voices put out there in terms of defining the issues and the terms. And we need to move towards making a real alliance with Six Nations and Indigenous people across Canada to stand up for human rights.
Hi, my name is Jane Wolkovich, and I guess I have a couple things to say. First of all, I'm a law student. I've gone back to school as a mature student to study law, so I want to also use the comments on international law as a starting point. That I think that what we talked about today is international law is very different than international law prior to colonization, and that we've, since colonization in this post-colonial country, we've codified a bunch of things, and we've got this body called the United Nations, which is really recent in terms of world history, that hasn't been started within the lifetime of many of the people in this room. And we are talking here in Caledonia about a situation that goes back almost exactly seven generations. And I also want to talk as a human being, where Larry and other people were up here talking about their ancestors, but my was liberated, so-called liberated, returned, redeemed, there's different words, from the Haudenosaunee after the Treaty of Paris was signed in 1783. And the Treaty of Paris was the first document, you could say, was an early document in international law. It ended the American Revolution, and it was the first document in which the 13 colonies were recognized as a separate nation, which we now know as the United States of America. And it's their Article 6 of the Treaty of Paris of 1783 said that all prisoners should be returned. And there was a whole bunch of people, including my ancestor, Michael Shaw, who at the age of 7, when his family was caught up in this Revolutionary War, were killed, and he was taken in by the Haudenosaunee and nurtured and fed, and they returned him after that Treaty of 1783. And then there were other treaties. There were earlier treaties like the Treaty of 1701. There were all kinds of other treaties. And those were treaties of international law. Even if the modern student of international law doesn't go back that far, those were international treaties signed between nations. And they were respected by the Haudenosaunee, by Joseph Brant and other people who were, because even though the Haudenosaunee were not signatories to the 1783 treaty, when that was signed and it said that prisoners were to be released, there was a whole release of people that were non-Aboriginal people living with the Haudenosaunee, and they were released because of the provisions of that treaty, even though the Haudenosaunee weren't signatories to it. And that is just one example. So there's lots and lots of other examples. And those of us who are descendants from that time, at least those of us who are non-Aboriginal people like me, who, as a white person, I have continued to benefit from those treaties. So we cannot say that those treaties are history and they're not relevant. Have continued to benefit by being able to breathe this air, drive these roads, partake in schooling and public education. When we have marriage breakup, I can divide the property with my husband or my ex-husband and not have to worry about what happens to the collective home of the nation. As I might have to, if I was a Muslim woman living on the reserve. You know, there's all kinds of benefits in all kinds of everyday ways that in my life, every day, in my children's life, every day, I have benefited from those treaties of the 1700s. And those benefits have continued to flow to me. I just want to tell one other story that came to my attention over the last little while. I live in Dundas, and we have school closures going on in Dundas. Some of you may have heard something about this, where due to birth rates or whatever, we don't need the school we used to need. And there's a family that had donated a school back in about 19. board at the time, and they wanted this to be used as a school forever. And they had this provision that if it was never to be used for a school again, that it should revert to the family. And meanwhile, because I was helping the family with some research on this, you know, I'm a student, I'm interested in figuring out the technicalities of what's going on, and I found a clause in the Education Act where the legislatures at the time said that, you know, we have, may have more schools than we need, we'll put a clause in the Education Act that if the school is not needed, that after 50 years, they can sell. So this family had no recourse, that basically the school was able to be sold. And I was standing there talking to an elderly woman in her 80s who said, so what is our recourse? If a family wants something to happen with a piece of land forever and ever and ever, and they think it's taken care of, and it's in the will, and it's in the deed, and then a legislature can just go and change that, you know, what is wrong with our legal system if that's possible? And it was a very profound question, but I go back to those people that were lawmakers and legislatures and treaty signers in 1701, and in 1783, and in 1763, and in all those other treaties that were signed. And they made solemn promises to each other at those times, and said that these things are to be respected forever and ever more. And it has been very one-sided that myself and my family has continued to benefit from those treaties for the last 200 years. And there's a whole bunch of other people that were also influenced by that treaty who have only had rights eroded and taken away and narrowed access to property and community decision-making, access to decisions that affect their lives and schooling, everything else, has only continued to be eroded and limited and narrowed since that time. So yes, it's important questions to ask in terms of what kind of control can we have forever and ever, but also what kinds of things can we solve together as a collective, because that's really what lawmaking is all about. Law is just a tool. It's what we decide as a collective society. This is what, and we do that either through tradition, through common law, through decisions made by judges, or through legislatures and lawmaking and statutes. And so law is not something that is sacred, that is unchangeable. It is changeable and made by human beings, and that all of us are human beings should have a say in that one way or another. And we need to work together to make sure the law is a tool so that we can live together in peace and harmony. Thank you.
My name is George Silver, and I'm not a lawyer. I remember you asking me to answer a stupid question. In fact, anybody here who is a lawyer hopefully can help with this. I'm under no illusions about the law being fair. I look at the bodies here on the table. Somebody is taking cat water and putting it in the bottles and selling them. That doesn't seem right, but it's legal, right? So I have some questions, two questions really that are extremely puzzling to me. One is the province apparently can sell land that they don't seem to own. I mean, if the federal government represents those who made the treaties with the Six Nations, then why is it that the federal government has to bow to the Ontario government on matters of sales of land? To me, that doesn't make any sense, but in a lot of things, it doesn't make any sense to me. The other question is, I would like you or anybody here who is a lawyer to try and put themselves into the head of Judge Marshall and explain to him what kind of law is he talking about? How is it that somebody like that, who to me has a conflict of interest because he has property, that say the people have to leave, the people who own that land have to leave before negotiations can continue. I mean, the arrogance of a person like that telling the federal government, the provincial government, and another nation what they can and cannot do just seems incredible. So I can't put myself in the head of that individual. And that's why I'd like a lawyer to try and do that. I don't think we should just dismiss these things. We need to understand where these people are coming from. And he's not the only one. Time after time after time, in the papers we read lawyers,
saying this is a question of law and order, ignoring completely the treaties. How is that possible, even if the law is not fair? Doesn't it have to be consistent? So I really would like an explanation, not just to tell me that it's not fair because all of us here know it's not fair. Where are these people coming from and how can they get away with it?
It's not just not fair, it's unconstitutional. The Constitution of Canada is supposed to be the overarching laws to which all other laws, statutory, etc., must abide. The Constitution says the first rule of the Constitution is the rule of law, this thing that Marshall talked about, but just give me a minute here. The rule of law means that we are all bound by the law. Governments, political leaders in particular, are as bound as anybody else, your average citizen. When governments break the law, then the rule of law is not being applied, and the actions or laws legislated by the government are not constitutional. The governments have broken the law for decades, centuries. They've broken treaty law. They've broken imperial law by purporting to assert sovereignty and then imposing abusive legal regimes, so-called legislative regimes, over indigenous peoples, like the Indian Act and others. In doing so, they defied the rule of law, and therefore these are unconstitutional acts. Okay, so it's not just unfair, it's unconstitutional. Why does this happen? How does it happen? Raw power. Who the hell is going to stop them? We, the apathetic huddled masses, who don't learn any of this stuff in school systems? Not likely in this generation, or maybe I'm being too cynical. Who's going to stop them? Indigenous peoples have been trying, but they've been impoverished, starved out, abused and oppressed for so long that capacity is often not there. And divide and conquer has to some extent worked. What had been powerful, strong nations have been divided up into what are now colloquially referred to by the federal government's communities, or bands, under the Indian Act, not nations. First Nations is a term that has been co-opted, by the way, by the federal crown under many land claim and other agreements defined on the first page. First Nations means band under the Indian Act. Nothing more, nothing inherent, nothing self-defined, but band under the Indian Act imposed by Canada. How does this happen? Power. That's how it happens. It's not constitutional, but again, we're all just sort of living in this surreal existence of this purported assertion of British sovereignty, not just over you and me and my ancestors and yours as non-Aboriginal people, but over Aboriginal peoples. It's a legal fiction. It's unconstitutional. It ignores pre-existing paramount laws called treaties. It's not constitutional. So that's how that, by the way, how Ontario gets to deal with this is we live in a bifurcated system of federal and provincial governments. And Section 109 of the 1867 Constitution Act says that provinces own so-called crown land, which, again, legal fictions, legal myths. Somehow, what had been Aboriginal type of land in many cases, and at the very least shared land through treaty, became now suddenly crown-owned. Legal myth. Power lets it happen, but that's why the province gets into the mix, because of Section 109 of the Constitution.
Can I just like to make a comment? I agree with what Kate said, that it turns out it's just a question of raw power. And to answer to George's question, I think you're not going to find the answer, if that's the case, by asking lawyers what to do, OK? okay? Like, that's the problem here, because if they're doing it so blatantly unconstitutional, this and this and this, you know, I mean, there is a whole industry to deal with that, but you're not going to solve it. We had 3 years of Stelco trying to use the bankruptcy legislation to violate our labor rights, our rights that we had under the Ontario Labor Relations Act. They tried, and again, we had 50 lawyers in the courtroom from the largest law firms in Ontario trying to make this happen. And we, you know, we opposed it legally, but the reason Stelco wasn't successful is we tried to deal with this question of power. Did they have the power to do it? So that's the role that our Thursday meetings, our discussions, our organizing amongst our members and pensioners, to take them on if they were going to make a move against us. So we did that, you know, for 3 years of, so that our members were armed, our pensioners were armed, what's happening in court with our Judge Farley, which is like the Judge Marshall, it's almost identical. But that's where we relied on to win. And at the end of the day, they weren't successful, and everybody's wondering, how the hell did we do that? Okay, so it's the same thing in this, in my opinion, in this situation. First, the Six Nations took a stand, which is the first thing you have to do if you want to sort the problem out. If they had never taken a stand, they could wait another 200 years and nobody would listen to them. Then you have to sort out, how do we get the power? So that's where you have to rely on the people. So in my opinion, that's why we got so much flack when we went there with our flags and wouldn't waver, wouldn't even hesitate. There was no hesitant. We just went, this is right. Because that's very dangerous that now this Canadian, you know, society, there's organizations and whatever who are now taking up this to make sure that justice is done. So that's right. That's how you have to do it. So, I mean, the lawyers definitely play a good role, for these sometimes in these fights. But when it's this situation facing, there's something else we have to deal with it a different way. Anyway, thank you.
We need to be able to see things through the eyes of many people. And Canada has, unfortunately, a very sad relationship with Native people. When you look at what happens in many communities of Native people where there's no running water, where that infant mortality is much higher than the rest of the population, where in some cases the water is not fit for human consumption, and yet the land that was owned by them is now being used to become very, very prosperous. And yet none of that prosperity being shared with the First Nations, I think we need to feel ashamed. This situation, although it's present all the time, never comes to the fore unless somebody goes and reports on some tragedy, such as suicides or some terrible social situation, or if a confrontation occurs due to a dispute over something like land and treaty rights. But when this happens, unfortunately, the people who report it are not Native, for the most part. The ones that report it to the mainstream media are not Native. And so therefore, we don't get the Native perspective on this. And what makes it worse is that if you look at the textbooks that children learn from, there's very little on Native history, much less on history seen through Native eyes. And so there is a lack of information, and the reporting through eyes that are not Native and by people who are equally ignorant about Native issues.
Redefining Radio.
Radio.